from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. As the U.S. extends its reach into the skies above northern Iraq, militants with the Islamic State continue to work on extending their reach on the ground. Kurdish forces are fighting back, and civilians, most notably hundreds of thousands of Yazidis, are fleeing what some people are calling genocide. President Barack Obama says there's a limit to what military intervention can do to stop the crisis, but within days of his decision to bomb the militants, critics are already circling in the U.S. to condemn him for not doing enough. Given what's happening in Syria and Libya, as well as Iraq, what is enough? We'll dig into that question in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Women and children fleeing barefoot toward the Syrian border. A prime minister with close to no support in Baghdad refusing to go. Bearded militants with a plan to install a modern-day caliphate, making effective use of captured American weapons and the internet to spread their message. The pressure is on the Obama administration to do something about the growing crisis in Iraq, but it's not clear there's much stomach here in the U.S. to get involved in another war. Let's hear first this morning from President Obama talking on Saturday about the goals of the military operation in Iraq.
We will protect our American citizens in Iraq, whether they're diplomats, civilians, or military. If these terrorists threaten our facilities or our personnel, we will take action to protect our people. We will continue to provide military assistance and advice to the Iraqi government and Kurdish forces as they battle these terrorists, so that the terrorists cannot establish a permanent safe haven.
Let's hear now from our guest this morning. Peter Mansour is chair in military history at Ohio State University, author of Surge, My Journey with General David Petraeus and the Remaking of the Iraq War. He served as a brigade commander in Iraq. Mr. Mansour, thank you for talking with us this morning.
My pleasure.
We have John Arquilla, chairman of the Defense Analysis Department at the Naval Postgraduate School. He's the author of Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits, How Masters of Irregular Warfare Have Shaped Our World. Good morning.
Good to be with you.
And last but not least, Borzu Deragahi, Middle East and North Africa correspondent for the Financial Times, formerly Beirut bureau chief for the LA Times. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Borzu Deragahi, I thought we'd start with you. Just give us the lay of the land. There's been an awful lot happening in Iraq over the last few days.
Well, yeah, I guess it's rather complicated and messy, but and unfolding and moving. But basically, what has happened is that Maliki's Shia rivals and even some of the people in his own political party have turned against him and joined forces with the Kurdish president, Fuad Masum, as well as the Sunni Speaker of Parliament in an attempt to oust Nouri Maliki from the premiership. They've named another person as the premier, Haider Abadi, a low-key UK-educated engineer who has been in party politics in Iraq for the last 11 years. They've named him as prime minister designate. It remains unclear whether Maliki will go quietly, whether he is going to challenge this in the courts or challenge this in the streets, or step aside as many Shia politicians, Sunni politicians, Kurdish politicians, and critically, the Shia senior clergy in the holy city in Najaf have urged him to do.
Does he have the military capacity to force the issue?
That's a good question. In theory, he does. But in reality, if you look at Iraq, you look at the composition of what has been described as a very sectarian force, they may be loyal to Maliki, but there is one person in Iraq, and I'm sure my other guests will agree who know Iraq, the other guests will agree, that there's one person in Iraq that they would respect more than Maliki, and that is the Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who has indicated very strongly and increasingly and forcefully that it's time for Maliki to go. So I don't think that Maliki would have much success in getting those security forces to act against the government as it is without the endorsement of the, or at least the acquiescence of the senior clergy. And in fact, There was a tweet today from the official page of the Iraqi army saying that we're Iraq's army, not Maliki's.
Peter Mansour, to paraphrase the famous phrase, nature abhors a political vacuum. And it seems the Islamic State is taking over large parts of Syria and now Iraq. How can a few airstrikes from the U.S. begin to change that dynamic?
Well, a few airstrikes can't completely alter the situation. It can halt an ISIS advance on the Kurdish region, which it succeeded in doing. And with the support of Kurdish Peshmerga, could potentially provide some sort of safe corridor to get the Yazidis off Sinjar Mountain and into the Kurdish region safe haven. But beyond that, it will require a substantial, a great deal more military support to roll back ISIS gains. It will require boots on the ground, and now those could be Iraqi or Kurdish boots, Sunni tribes, but they will require U.S. support, training and equipping support, potentially advisors, maybe even special forces and attack helicopters. What we've seen in the last 3 months is that the Iraqi forces just aren't very capable because they've been turned into Nouri al-Maliki's private militia, and that will take some time to reverse. But I think this is the beginning of potentially a strategic shift if you have a formation of a government in Baghdad that all Iraqis can support, then I think you'll see the Obama administration becoming much more forthcoming with a greater military assistance.
John Orquillas, is that your read of the situation?
Yes, I think we're moving now into the second part of President Obama's three-part strategy, the first being to stem the ISIS tide on the ground, second, to see true reform in the government. The third part in this is the trickiest, of course, and that's negotiating the relationship with Iran. And Iran may play a role here in getting Maliki to step down quietly. I think we should look at this, above all, as evidence that we shouldn't simply have walked away at the end of 2011.
Borzu Deragahi, President Obama insists the U.S. is not going to be the air force of Iraqi Shiites or any other faction. Even if Maliki does step down, what hope can the rest of the world have that the government that is formed next is one that really does promise to represent all the different peoples of Iraq?
Well, ISIS was able to exploit the situation in Iraq because of the missteps of the Maliki government, because of the sectarian tendencies of the Maliki government. The hope is that a more functional government, a more representative government, will be able to take on the vast institutional challenges of rebuilding the armed forces, of challenging ISIS on the ground, of giving some credibility and some comfort to those Sunnis who feel aggrieved right now about the their treatment at the hands of the government, and have them turn against the ISIS the insurgents, as happened during the last part of the last decade when Sunnis in Iraqi communities turned against ISIS's predecessor, al-Qaeda, in Iraq.
A lot of Americans see the Middle East as a fairly homogenous place, ethnically and religiously speaking, but it goes far beyond Shiites and Sunnis. There are Christians and Shabaks and Yazidis and Zoroastrians, and, you know, we don't even have time to list them all here. Do those minority groups have any say in what gets developed, or is this just going to be some kind of a deal struck between Shiites and Sunnis to stop killing each other and others?
Well, I mean, there is this sort of ideal of an Iraq where these communities live in harmony with each other. I think that that is an ideal that is cherished by many Iraqi people. Unfortunately, because of the security situation, because of the dire situation in Iraq over the last few years, especially the last 2 years, you know, that ideal has taken a real beating. Many people who harbor that ideal have left the country, have been forced out of the country. If Iraq is made into a more stable place, I think that ideal can be rekindled, and people who are of those minorities will feel comfortable enough to remain in the country.
John Orquilla, you know, we've talked a little bit here about the idea of arming, or more fulsomely arming, the Kurds. But is that a realistic idea, or just wishful thinking? We'd like the Kurds to be our troops on the ground.
Well, I think the Kurds are militarily quite competent. We already see they're retaking some towns. There is a larger concern, and one of the reasons the Kurds were outgunned by ISIS is that the central government was very concerned about arming them too well. They might just break away. Remember, there are strong separatist sentiments up in the north, and that, too, could be a cause of a future conflict there. This is a very, very complex situation, and holding the country together is going to depend absolutely on Maliki stepping down and a far more inclusive government coming into place.
Peter Mansour, perhaps the answer is that we need to let go of established country boundaries and accept that Iraq was a creation built in, you know, around World War One that doesn't really work.
You know, I reject that notion. Iraq today is an older state than Germany was in 1945. When I was there, I didn't get any sense from any faction in Iraq that they wanted the state to split apart. Now, certain regions want more autonomy, and that's something that the Iraqis can negotiate and discuss among one another. But there really isn't a lot of support for actually breaking the country into three parts, other than the Kurds, who would like eventual independence. But the Sunnis and the Shia, I think the way ahead for them is to figure out a way to share power and resources such that each community is satisfied.
Do you agree, Borzu Deragahi?
Well, yeah, I think that's there is no other way, actually. Although there have been more and more people who say that they, for example, they've been talking about a separate Sunni region, no Sunnis, let's put the Kurds aside for the moment, who've sought autonomy and independence for more than a century now, but no Sunni in the country actually wants to create a country out of their Sunni parts of the country. There are desolate desert flatlands, mostly, that are not productive and so on. What they've been talking about is a more autonomous structure that would give the Sunnis a little bit of more control over their own security forces, which have been a point of contention in Iraq, as well as some resources and so on. And that is not a call for separation. That's a call for some kind of confederate or federal structure akin to, say, Germany or France or even the United States, where states have a lot of autonomy.
Well, speaking of the states, let's travel back to the U.S. right now and talk about what's going on here after the president's initial announcement that there would be airstrikes. We have lots of people criticizing him. Even Hillary Clinton is pulling away, saying, well, I argued we should have gone in more forcefully in Syria a few years ago. And then we have John McCain speaking yesterday on CNN's State of the Union.
This is turning into, as we had predicted for a long time, a regional conflict, which does pose a threat to the security of the United States of America. And launching three strikes around a place where horrible humanitarian crisis is taking place. Meanwhile, ISIS continues to make gains everywhere. Yes, is clearly very, very ineffective, to say the least.
Peter Mansour, I mean, it sounds like there's some momentum building, at least in among Washington, D.C. politicians, to do something bigger in Iraq. But is that necessarily something that's going to carry with the average American?
It will have to. We cannot allow an Islamic State under this murderous group of thugs to exist. If it were to create some sort of proto-state in that region, they will inevitably inject violence into the rest of the Middle East and then into the Western world and the broader world as a whole. This is a group that has a messianic vision of what it wants to accomplish, and it will stop at nothing. No amount of terror or genocide is underneath its vision of the future. And so it's really the face of evil in the world today, and Americans are going to have to get used to the idea that we're going to have to use military force in conjunction with allies to destroy it.
John Aquila, is that where you see this conversation going?
Yeah, I think the president is trying to do what Bill Clinton would call triangulation. He's going to get some political pressure to escalate. The American public is tired, and most feel that the war in Iraq was a mistake in the first place, and I was among those over a decade ago feeling the same way. But he has to recognize that some kind of presence is necessary. So I think the president is going to thread the needle here and use, if there is an Obama doctrine, it's about using force in very economical ways. And so I think he's going to try to solve the problem militarily with the least amount of force possible, keeping the public mollified, the political criticism at a level he can tolerate, and hopefully achieving through political inclusion in the government there and some quiet agreement with the Iranians, a solution that works out. That would be the triangulated answer to this problem.
Borzu Deragahi, I mean, from the perspective of many people living in the Middle East, Americans seem to have a great deal of tolerance for the suffering of all kinds of people, not just the Yazidis, even though that's a terrible situation unfolding that I'm sure speaks to a lot of Americans watching it now. Do you talk to people who are confident that the Americans are going to rise to this military and political challenge, or do people sort of take a laid-back, more cynical view, like, we'll see what happens and when?
I think, interestingly, there hasn't been a lot of, you know, when was the last time that the U.S. Bombed an Arab country and you didn't have, like, people protesting and so on? Even Libya.
Well, Libya, right? Yeah.
Which, but, you know, even Libya, you had some protests. You had some people upset. But, you know, except for, like, a few nut job leftists in the West, very few people in the Arab world have made noise about these bombings. Everyone here is afraid of ISIS, Daesh, they call it, which in Arabic is a very frightening sounding word. It has taken on this real frightening allure, this group. It is threatening much of the Middle East, Sunni, whether Sunni, whether Shia, whether Persian, whether Arab, whether republic or monarchy. And this has you know, frightened a lot of people. So I think everyone here is taking a wait and see attitude to see what the U.S. will be able to do with these pinprick strikes. They should be described as. And yeah, there is some talk of hypocrisy. Why is the U.S. doing this to protect the Kurds and the Yazidis, but why didn't it do something to protect the tens of thousands of Syrians who've been killed in Bashar al-Assad's terror campaign against the Syrian Sunnis?
And yet, for all the people that seem to be afraid of the Islamic State and have something to lose, it does seem to be rallying support, not just among outsiders like folks from Pakistan or even Belgium, but from people in Syria and Iraq.
Well, I think that there's a couple different pictures here. I think that in Syria, it has not so much rallied support as very little support, perhaps, but it has cowed other opposition groups, other Sunni groups and Sunni people into submission with its terror tactics. And in Iraq, it's working slightly differently. It's mostly forming alliances with insurgent groups that have already been there. So in that way, it's been able to project its power enormously. And I'm sure Peter and your other guests can comment a little bit about this. They've been able to project their power tremendously without having a lot of troops themselves by relying on these, let's call them legacy insurgent groups that were the 2003 U.S. invasion. And those are the groups that are, to some extent, running things on the ground there. And that explains their acceptance. That explains what we see as the acceptance of this Daesh phenomena, this ISIS phenomena in parts of Iraq.
So it almost functions, I'm thinking, like a McDonald's franchise in the sense that there's like a national or an international chain, and then there are local operations
that report to it? No. I would say more like like the UN that has like local partner groups. The UN has like partners, little tiny NGO partners all over the world. I don't mean to malign the UN, but it operates more like that with different brands and different logos, different names, but still operating to some extent under the ISIS banner.
Is it then seen as a local operation or outsiders coming in?
You know, one of the things that was really interesting from the few witness accounts that have come out of Sinjar, this area where the Yazidis were, was that none of the people, all of the people who were doing the terrorizing were described as local Sinjar Arabs who were doing this. No one, according to the best testimony that we have, there's no description of foreigners coming there. No one with foreign, and as people who know the Arab world, it's very easy to identify who is from which part of the Arab world based on their accents. And what people were saying is that these were local people who were doing this.
John Arquilla, this seems to argue that there's a political dynamic happening in Iraq which is not entirely unwelcome by the local population.
Oh, absolutely right, Rachel. I think the Sunnis have been so disaffected since we walked away at the end of 2011 because Maliki really turned his rule into a sectarian regime. So they're trying to recapture some sense of their own contributions to governance, equity in the society, and ISIS offers them the opportunity to do this. Now, when we defeated al-Qaeda in Iraq several years ago, it was on the basis of driving a wedge between the al-Qaeda fighters and the Sunnis, who, again, were feeling dispossessed since the fall of Saddam, and that awakening turned the tide in the war. Now we have an opportunity to pursue a reawakening in Iraq by once again reaching out to those Sunnis and ensuring that they will have a voice in government, that it will be inclusive, and I think there's a chance to break the ties to ISIS, because the terrorists would be making very, very little progress unless there was a great deal of Sunni popular support.
Borzu Deragahi, I know you have just a few more minutes to be with us today, and so I wanted you to respond to Sean, who has written in, it's unclear to me why the U.S. has to be the one intervening in Iraq, especially if Obama was elected on the mandate to get the U.S. out of Iraq. There are several powers in the region, Iran, you've mentioned, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, etc., who can just as easily conduct airstrikes. We shouldn't have been in Iraq in 2003, and we shouldn't be there today. Are there other regional powers or perhaps other global powers that could be perhaps joining the U.S. or taking the place of the U.S.?
Well, I think Peter might be a better person to comment on this. There's a technical dimension here. I don't think that many other world powers have the sort of aircraft tools necessary to conduct the kind of precision strikes that seem to be required at this point in Iraq right now to sort of hold back the ISIS advance without getting civilians caught in the crossfire and so on, to locate them, to sort of have an integrated intelligence and military and surveillance system whereby they can conduct this kind of operation. I think perhaps Turkey could help in terms of surveillance and reconnaissance, and I think it already is. It's a NATO partner, Turkey. But in terms of other regional countries, no, there aren't a lot of other regional countries. Maybe Israel, but that would be hugely politically expensive to allow Israel to traverse Iraqi airspace for historical and political reasons. But I would defer to Peter on the technical questions.
Well, Borzu Deragahi, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to read your reportage in the Financial Times and before that in the Los Angeles Times. Thank you again.
It's been a pleasure.
We're talking about the crisis in Iraq. What do you think? How involved should the U.S. be, and how exactly? Call us at 866-733-6786. You can also, well, I'm going to say that number again just in case you're picking up your pen right now, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions online. We're reading all of it, and we'll be back in just a moment with our guests Peter Mansour and John Arquilla. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. This hour, we're talking about Iraq with Peter Mansour, Chair in Military History at Ohio State University, and John Arquilla, Chairman of the Defense Analysis Department at the Naval Postgraduate School. Peter Mansour, I wanted to start this second half hour with you, getting into that question of who the U.S.'s allies are in this fight.
Well, we'll have many more allies once we have a government in Baghdad that those allies can support. So it's easy to say, well, let the Saudi aircraft bomb ISIS. but they don't want to be seen as supporting Nouri al-Maliki any more than we want to be seen as supporting Nouri al-Maliki. In Saudi eyes, Maliki is an Iranian stooge and a Persian pawn. Turkey, on the other hand, although it would like to see ISIS eliminated, it doesn't necessarily want to support the Kurds who are pushing for independence, although there has been some rapprochement between the Kurds and the Turks of late. They will be very wary in supporting any sort of effort in northern Iraq, although I think they'll be supportive in the end. And then there's the question of capabilities. The United States is really the indispensable nation in this regard. If you want to conduct an effective air campaign on the ground in Iraq against ISIS and do it without huge amounts of collateral damage to the civilians there, only the United States has the capabilities to do this.
The world is watching what's happening to the Yazidis. Basically, they're fleeing barefoot into the mountains there near the Syrian border. One representative from the UN Secretary General told the Christian Science Monitor, regrettably, the information indicates they're not even given the choice of life or conversion, but are being treated as a group to be eliminated from the face of the earth. Does that situation, does the prospect of ISIS basically picking off ethnic groups create any kind of political momentum for local countries to consider getting more involved? I mean, are there people within the Middle East who say, well, you know, Turkey got involved because what happened to the Yazidis could happen to us next?
Well, I think it's a call for all of mankind to get involved. This is genocide by any definition of the term. And if we've learned anything from the Holocaust, from the Rwanda slaughter, and from other places around the world, it's that humankind, is lessened when we allow a group like this to be systematically slaughtered for its beliefs. So I think this is should be a wake-up call to the entire international community that we cannot allow this this cancer to grow. This very extreme group that's, you know, I didn't think we could find a group more extreme than Al-Qaeda, but ISIS has found that space.
John Arquilla, would it help if there was some kind of coalition, or has the global community developed a kind of jaundiced view of coalitions of the willing?
Well, you have to remember that the international community rejected our rationale for invading Iraq in 2003, and many Americans agreed with that view of the international community. So just as many Americans don't want to go back in, I think it will also be hard to bring an international coalition together. I think Colonel Mansour has made a very good point that there are ethical reasons to take action now that should appeal broadly around the world. This is indeed genocide that ISIS is trying to perpetrate. And it doesn't really matter if others won't sign up. We have this obligation. All of us, all the countries who signed the 1948 Genocide Convention, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights back at that time, have an obligation to act in the face of this. And the president has seized this moment to take action. Now there's a practical and strategic interest that happens to coincide with the ethical imperative. And I think the president has been skillful in blending these.
Let's turn now to the phones. We have Ed in Morgan Hill.
Hi,
Ed.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Fantastic discussion. It's interesting that you're talking so much about World War II, because my comment is basically I was completely against going into Iraq in 2003, but now it seems that ISIS forms one of the clearest opponents and threats to the United States since Germany in World War II, and I think we definitely need to go in and take care of them before they can do more damage and before they can take root. I'd also like to ask: is the rise of ISIS an unintended consequence of Obama's effectiveness in taking out the leadership of Al-Qaeda? It seems that he's been quietly taking out a lot of their top people, and I'm wondering if that's weakened Al-Qaeda and allowed something stronger and more vile to take shape.
Great question, Ed. Peter Mansour, do you want to tackle that? Basically, destroying Al-Qaeda has helped to give rise to ISIS.
I actually think that the rise of ISIS is the unintended consequence of our misbegotten invasion of Iraq in 2003. I would agree with the listener in that regard. I guess you have to ask yourself the question, if Osama bin Laden were still alive and if al-Qaeda were still a going concern, would ISIS exist or not? And I think it still would. It's a local movement that has gained international jihadist support because of its successes. But it's had the maneuvering space to grow because of the civil war in Syria. And so you have to look really more at what caused the civil war in Syria to grow and give the space for these jihadist groups to prosper rather than to whether al-Qaeda has been destroyed or not.
Are the soldiers who are fighting with ISIS, are they good soldiers or are they just people going up against really weak enemies?
I think it's a bit of both, but they have a lot of combat experience from the fighting in Syria. So now they are definitely, they have expertise. They now have good weapons that they've seized from the Iraqi army. And they have a lot of financial wherewithal. And it's really the expertise that they've gained in the war in Syria that's allowing them a degree of overmatch over their opponents in the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga. But we shouldn't hold these guys up as some sort of new rendition of the Waffen-SS. They can be beat, and it will require U.S. support to create forces that are equal to them and superior to them on the battlefield.
Ed, thank you so much for your question. Let's turn now to Colin in San Francisco.
Good morning. Isn't the fact that the U.S. military is now directly intervening in the conflict in Iraq against ISIS represent a propaganda coup for ISIS? The other one you can represent to the rest of the extremists in the Muslim world that they're the only ones who are fighting the crusaders.
Great question. John Arquilla, basically the White House has noticed ISIS. Does that not make them seem more impressive to others in the region?
There's no question that it feeds an ISIS narrative that will bring them recruits from here and there. But let's remember that Dr. Zawahiri of al-Qaeda, the current leader of al-Qaeda, has rejected this group. So if your young man wants to get your jihad on, there's still a lot of room to join up with al-Qaeda in many places. Just killing bin Laden and killing the number threes in al-Qaeda has not really gravely damaged the network. It's still operating in Yemen, Somalia, Mali, Mauritania, many other countries. And I think Dr. Zawahiri has a little bit of a battle of the story going on with ISIS. And I think these actions that ISIS has taken, particularly against the Yazidis and Christian, Chaldean, and other Christian communities in Iraq, undermines its own narrative, much as the excesses of al-Qaeda in Iraq helped us drive a wedge between them and Iraqis about 7 years ago. So I think, there's some cost. Again, nothing comes free in this world but the grace of God. And President Obama's made a choice that I think will effectively deal, certainly on the ground, against ISIS. In the information campaign, yes, they'll make a little hay out of this, but not too much.
Thank you so much, Colin. Another Colin writes, the Obama administration and Congress have been indifferent to the killings of civilians in the Gaza Strip by the Israeli government, as well as the deaths of hundreds of thousands of civilians in the Syrian conflict. Why should the American government take any military action for the protection of any civilians in Iraq? As a taxpayer, why should I have to pay for bombing one side in civil war that shows no sign of ever coming to an end? Peter Mansour, do you want to address that one?
Yeah, I would make the point that it's in our national interest to do so in the case of the Islamic State, because this is a group that harbors significant ill will against our nation and our allies. And we just to allow it to sort of evolve naturally and carve out this proto-state in that part of the world, we will inevitably see terrorism injected back into our nation. By some accounts, there's up to 100 U.S. Passport holders who are members of ISIS. They can fly into the country without a visa and wreak all sorts of havoc in our nation, which is relatively unprotected internally against terrorism. So this is in our national interest. It's not some sort of picking one set of civilians over another.
John Arquilla, do you think the threat is that imminent?
Oh, I think ISIS has very local goals right now. The colonel is right. They do have a global reach in terms of network members who can go to many places, not just the United States, but the European Union and back to their own countries with their combat experience. Look, I wrote a whole book about how these irregulars have been shaping our world for the last couple of centuries, and they're about to do so again. We're living in a time of the first great war between nations and networks of all sorts. And guess what? We've spent a couple $1 trillion between Iraq and Afghanistan. Our war on terror has in many respects become terror's war on the world. So I agree fully that we have a deep strategic interest in making sure that Iraq doesn't implode.
Let's go now to Richard in San Francisco.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to say that I agree with the strike strategy that Obama has brought about. But my question would be, is as far as boots on the ground, wouldn't it behoove us to open up the armories and give as many bullets and guns to the Kurds as they possibly could, given their reputation as the fierce fighters that they are?
Peter Mansour, this is a popular argument. Fully arm the Kurds.
Yeah, I think up until recently, the problem was that arming the Kurds would encourage them to declare independence and then break Iraq apart, and that was not what we needed politically, given the very delicate negotiations over the formation of a new government in Baghdad. But now, in the current situation where the Kurdish region is actually under military threat from ISIS, I agree with the caller. I think we should start arming the Kurdish Peshmerga while working with them and making it clear to them that they should not declare independence at this time, that should remain a future goal that should evolve naturally and in concordance with Baghdad and not in opposition to it.
If you've been watching this drama unfold, listener, call us now to ask questions about any aspect of this, the Obama administration's strategy, what's happening right now in Iraq, what's happening in the region, in Libya and Syria. Call us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Of course, you can email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there. John Arquilla, I'm wondering, now that there is basically a fight over the leadership of Iraq in Baghdad, does it really matter how it plays out specifically? Might this not be a moment when the U.S. can step in and not be seeing be favoring one side or another?
I think what the United States must favor is an inclusive democratic process. It's very clear that Maliki, trying to hold on to power, has tried to mount something along the lines of a coup, tanks around his residence, flouting the recommendations of the leading Shia theologian in the country. And I think unless, again, we go back to the trickiest part of the Obama strategy, unless he feels that the Iranians are no longer behind him whatsoever, I think he's going to try to hold on. And how this plays out matters very, very greatly. And it seems to me there's almost a perverse kind of logic here, that if ISIS is defeated very swiftly, Maliki may feel more confidence in trying to hold on to power. The greater the threat to Iraq, the greater the pressure on him to step down. So as I said before, it's a very, very complex and counterintuitive situation. But how it plays out, we're not favoring a particular person. We're favoring a particular process, and we're not seeing that in place yet.
Bill writes in, and it's a long message, so I'm going to summarize it. But basically, Bill describes the situation in Iraq as a boiling pot, and it says unless the U.S. is prepared to commit thousands of troops and billions of dollars to keep that lid on, at some point that lid is going to come off. And, you know, what will we find under it? Still boiling water. So if we go in and metaphorically jam the lid on the pot again, is that going to solve the problem? Of course not, Bill says. Anyone who suggests otherwise is living in fantasy land. Peter Mansour, I mean, are we just basically having an argument with ourselves about what we want to happen versus what we can realistically accomplish?
I actually disagree with that characterization. And as I've written in my book, Surge, after the surge in 2007-2008, we had created conditions in Iraq for politics actually to succeed. And had we, as John has mentioned, actually supported the constitutional process after the elections of 2010 and supported the winner of that election, Ayad Alawi, instead of backing, quote, our guy, Maliki, we would not be in this situation right now. The idea that Iraqis are just naturally prone to fight one another and that they hate one another and that this is an artificially created state that has no basis in historical reality is just false. Iraq is older now today than Germany was in 1945. It has a real sense of nationalism, and leaving the Kurdish region aside for a bit, because it has perhaps different aspirations, Arabs want to see the country break apart, especially the Sunnis, who would be left without oil and without a viable state. So this is something that I think the United States can assist with, but we need to make it clear to whoever takes the reins of power in Baghdad that we will not tolerate, nor will we support, a government that is as sectarian and brutal as the Maliki regime was.
We have a listener who disagrees with you. Joseph writes, your guest's comment that Iraq is an older country than Germany was in 1945 is a bit disingenuous. While that's factually true, the states that were united into a German nation in 1871 shared a millennia-old sense of Germanic identity and common culture. Prior to the British Mandate, there was no concept of an Iraqi people or culture. The country was poorly conceived for purely Western purposes, and it makes little sense to fight to keep it united.
Well, I mean, we can agree to disagree on this. I was in Iraq for 28 months, and I never ran across a single Iraqi in my travels with General Petraeus and with my brigade that didn't view himself as an Iraqi. We saw when they won the Asia Cup soccer tournament, Iraqi flags broke out in every part of Iraq, Shia, Sunni, Kurd. And, you know, they were celebrating a soccer victory of their national team. Too bad the listener can't go to Iraq and see for himself because of the violence there, but unfortunately we're going to have to leave it at that. I think that the Iraqi state can survive and is a viable construct.
Let's turn to a different question now. Phil in Burlingame.
So I'm very curious to hear what your panelists think about the role of Iran. Iran was supporting Syria, prevented U.S. intervention, and then Hezbollah, which is a proxy Iranian army in Lebanon, has marched into Syria and is part of the pro-Assad. But the ISIL people are, rebels against that, and are the Iranians supporting them? And we know the Iranians are supporting Maliki.
That's a good question. John Arcula, do you want to jump in there?
Yes, we have both conflicts with Iran, but also areas of cooperation. And not only is Syria on the table, but also there's the issue of Iranian nuclear proliferation. And I think, clearly we're on opposite sides in Syria. President Obama has spoken against the Assad regime. Clearly, we don't want them to develop nuclear weapons, but we have an area of agreement here about opposition to ISIS in Iraq. And as I said earlier, this is the trickiest part of the Obama strategy. I think right now we have to find a way to agree with the Iranians about keeping Iraq as a unitary state, and we have to encourage the Iranians to nudge Maliki into leaving peacefully. There's still going to be a Shia-majority government, which is in the interest of Tehran. Now, what the Iranians are going to ask in return for this is probably the subject of quiet diplomacy going on, but there is an opportunity here, I think, to take this tremendously complex and dangerous situation and turn it into one in which we might actually build on the cooperation with Iran over this Iraq issue and perhaps come to a favorable resolution of the proliferation problem and perhaps even work jointly to bring an end to the civil war in Syria. So risk, but also opportunity.
Thank you so much, Phil. Kumar in Fremont.
Oh, thank you. I humbly noted that we have spent trillions of dollars in Iraq and that part of the world, arming our so-called allies, and then also trillions of dollars in intelligence gathering, both here and abroad. Is it a failure of our defense establishment and, most importantly, the security apparatus that we have not to have foreseen the quick rise of the ISIS?
Peter Mansour?
You're going to have to restate the question.
Oh, so he's basically saying, you know, we've spent billions of dollars, both militarily and in terms of military and political intelligence in this region. How did we miss ISIS coming up so quickly?
Well, there are indications through my contacts in the intelligence agencies that we didn't miss the rise of ISIS. We misjudged its strength, but not its rise. But intelligence requires two things. It requires analysts who make the right determinations, and then it requires an administration willing to read and accept the intelligence analysis. And I don't think we had the latter in this case. It was in the White House, in the West Wing, they just refused to believe that ISIS was going to become as potent as it did. And perhaps there wasn't enough of a clarion call among the intel agencies saying these guys are becoming very capable and could pose a real threat to the integrity of the Iraqi state. I think that it's going to take years to sort of unpack this as the various top secret intel estimates get declassified, probably a half century from now.
John Aquila, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think we have an intelligence establishment that's largely built around the assessment of nations. And one of the things the National Counterterrorism Center is doing right now is trying to develop capacity for assessing the rise of networks. And basically, a network can mobilize very quickly. I liken it to a swarm of bees. They go from 0 to 60 very, very fast. And I think we're on the cusp in both military and the other aspects of our intelligence community of really developing a better understanding. The colonel is right. We knew ISIS was out there. Our lack of habituation to the manner in which these networks operate got us a little behind the curve in terms of how quickly they could mobilize and move as they have. But our learning curve is good, and I'm confident that we'll get much better at this.
John Aquila, I'm just wondering, given that ISIS has proved very adept at grabbing American weapons, what's to say they won't just grab whatever we send over now?
Well, I think that part of their campaign is over, and you have to remember that it was the really quick movement was in the Sunni areas where the indigenous Iraqi Sunnis were supporting them, and so they took over some of those arsenals. They're certainly not going to be getting weapons that we give to the Peshmerga because the Kurds are going to be shooting at them and are already doing so quite effectively. So I think that part of it, stealing the arsenal, is over. The quick movement's over, and the problem that ISIS has is they are a network, but they're trying to act like a nation. You know, they've rebranded themselves the Islamic State. And guess what? We're pretty good at fighting opponents who look like nations or states. And if they want to hold territory, we know how to pound them out of it. And so I think they've made a little bit of a strategic mistake. Even these dark and dangerous enemies we face don't stand 10 feet tall. They make mistakes, and I think ISIS has overstretched here.
Kumar, thank you so much. David in San Francisco.
About 20 years ago when George Bush Sr. went into Iraq, he forgot to bring out all of those weapons. And so when they were laying around, a lot of strife got developed, and that helped cause the rise of Osama bin Laden. But I have to disagree with your guest. There's plenty of evidence that ISIS was created by the Saudi Arabians and Kuwait, and the U.S. government has helped provide them weapons because we've been trying to beat out Syria in order to put in some natural gas pipelines. Those natural gas pipelines are said to be worth $24 trillion. And these pipelines would be sending gas up to Europe. So when you look at the various action regions of strife down there, in fact, even Gaza has natural gas underneath it. Dick Cheney has now gotten natural gas. He's gotten some grants to put in natural gas wells in the Gaza Heights, in the Golan Heights.
Well, I'm going to ask you to wrap up, David, just so we can ask our guest to respond. You're basically saying you can't look at this situation without looking at oil and gas, right?
and specifically natural gas, because the Saudi Arabians and specifically Saudi Prince Bandar are very invested in destroying the Syrian government in order to get these pipelines through.
So let's now put that to John R. Quillick. What do you think about this assessment?
Well, I don't think that the pursuit of oil and gas is the reason behind the rise of ISIS nor the strife in Iraq. Certainly, there are calculations about energy, and the Carter Doctrine enunciated back in 1979 was all about ensuring the flow of oil out of the Gulf region, no matter who might be threatening it. And I think it might be time for us just to, at that level, remind everybody that the Carter Doctrine still makes a kind of sense. We're looking at a tremendous amount of unrest in what is, in terms of resources and geopolitics, both the most volatile and one of the most important parts of the world.
Can we expect to see some resolution in the Middle East if we don't consider the role of Saudi Arabia in it?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia's role is considered in many ways, and they remain, and they've been an ally of the United States, a steady one for 75 years, both manipulating the prices of oil to help end the Cold War, the oil price drops, reducing the capacities of the old Soviet Union. I think they have...
Very quickly now.
yes. They played a role, and they've made clear that they, too, support a unitary Iraq, which is the ultimate goal here.
Thank you so much. John R. Quillick from the Naval Postgraduate School and Peter Mansour, Chair in Military History at Ohio State University. You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.